Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters with Veronica Entwistle. And this is a show in which I like to talk to people that I consider or I deem that are making a big difference on the planet through some kind of creative, inventive, it doesn't matter how, but they're making a difference on the planet. And I have a wonderful guest today. She's a good friend, but also she is a real producer of things that lift people and bring them, probably bring their hearts open. My friend Jonquil Lemaster. Hi, Jonquil. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to talk to you about the kinds of trees that you create. They're not real live trees, but you bring your trees that you design as an artist to life. That's a hard thing to say. And then you decorate them with crystals, and they have taken places in the world, like in Grand Central Station and great wineries and so on, and they really lift people. So let's talk about what got you doing this kind of thing.
Okay, great.
What started you off? You've been an artist for many years?
I have, yes. My whole career, pretty much, has been in some form of art and has just evolved into building trees of all different kinds for all different reasons. Habitats, just sheer decoration. And as you mentioned, the chandeliers that are just sort of light sculptures in the form of a tree with lights and crystals.
Mm-hmm. That are very vividly alive, even though they're made of acrylic and wire and all that sort of thing. Well, not the crystals, but the trees themselves, right? But you have a real affinity for nature, do you not? Is that where it all started? How did it all get started?
Well, it's hard to put my finger on it. I mean, I've always loved being out of doors. I can't, you know, put my mind around, well, it started when I was two or anything like that. I grew up with my family in Florida where it was really easy to be outdoors. So I would have to give some credit to that, where you're just out sort of munging around in nature and digging things up and swimming and walking and always, always feeling comfortable out of doors, I should say, and then moved to the Pacific Northwest, which is covered with trees, as we know, or used to be anyway. And that's another great opportunity to be outdoors. I didn't, you know, purposefully go out there because I was troubled or because I needed something that I wasn't getting. It just seemed natural, I guess, to always incorporate that into my life. And then I was just offered a fabulous opportunity in the 80s to move to New York City and build a jungle for Jungle World at the Bronx Zoo, along with another, with a whole group of incredibly talented and dedicated people who believed and still believe that it's important to conserve habitats for animals, endangered or otherwise.
Is that so? Animals who live in a zoo have got a sense of home?
Right. I mean, there was a big transformation that went on or sort of began and gained steam and has gone on to create a whole vivid and vital world of conservation. At the time that I was gifted to take part of that, some of the major institutions around the world were beginning to understand that if they could recreate natural habitats, naturalistic habitats for endangered species, that they might breed in captivity. So here are all of these animals on the brink of extinction. They bring them into a concrete environment and wonder why they don't flourish. Hello. You
know, yeah, who would? Eh?
You know, but the light bulbs were going on everywhere, you know, with much more influential people than me. I just happened to have the grace of being able to be on a team of people that was tasked with recreating some natural habitats. And mine was the trees. It was kind of the thing. No one really knew how to do it. It was like, okay, with all your skills and your expertise and your thinking, what are we doing here? You know, mm-hmm.
But wait a minute, you came out of university as an artist, did you not?
I did. I got a degree in art here in Oregon and went into working at a museum setting. And so I was building and working in museums, you know, which are great institutions, usually sharing. That was mostly cultural history, so human history.
I love the story about you having a desire and really wanting to get involved in the building of things. You told me a funny story earlier about that and about how you had the opportunity. You want to tell that story? I love it. People will love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was working here in Portland and in Oregon, and there was a group of people in Central Oregon patterning a natural and cultural history museum after the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum in Tucson. So here in Oregon, this group of people were going to build the High Desert Museum in Bend, and that was going to include natural habitats for the regional animals that are already there, so people can come and see who lives in your high desert, you know. And I was over there working on the two-dimensional exhibits inside and all the interpretive graphics. And these guys had come up from Arizona to build these waterways and these fountains and waterfalls and a creek system that was going to look natural and have fish in it. And I went outside and I thought, what are you guys doing? And I just kind of was captivated by what were they doing? And they said, well, you know, we're putting in a pump here and we're going to recirculate this water. And it'll run down through these 20 acres and recirc, and, you know, there'll be habitat all around it. And I just couldn't believe it. And I just sort of bugged them until I asked them, I said, I want to know how to do this. And they said, well, you know, girls don't really work in this field. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I could do this. And they said, well, okay, get down here and start mixing cement, you know. And so I volunteered and came back a couple of times and just did whatever I was told. You know, they were doing very interesting things and shooting plaster cement. And then Merv Larson was the guy who owned that company, and he invented all these different ways of creating rock texture. One of them that I thought was so fascinating that he took like a sandblasting, like you would sandblast the surface of something to clean it off. Mm-hmm. He made a bypass gun that would do that, except that it was big enough that you could shoot rock salt at this soft plaster cement. So we were broadcasting under pressure rock salt onto this surface. And then after it hardened, they'd wash it off and the salt would dissolve out. It looked exactly like lava rock. All
wow.
of this rock that was all around. Naturally, they'd recreated this fountain, this waterfall that had all these characteristics that looked exactly right. So that was it. You know, we'd like, okay, how can I... That was what was so captivating to me. And that's what happened when we were building the trees. It's like, okay, I see how these trees look. I get that we can't have living ones because, you know, you can't cut them down in the Amazon and bring them up here, or Southeast Asia in our case. Besides the fact, you know, they're 300 feet tall and we only need the bottom 40 feet. So what are we doing here? You know, so, and the materials, all construction materials, they don't necessarily want to behave in a way that ends up looking beautiful and like a big buttress tree. So we're just like, okay, how can I make this happen? What is it? What can I do? How can I sculpt this? What materials, what tools, what will it take to make this artificial tree look as close as it can to a real one, so that you're doing two things. One, you are opening up people's imagination. So they come to the exhibit, they're learning about animals, and they're immersed in a habitat that they can't tell isn't real. Mm. And what happens when they're in there? Then they just, it's like osmosis. It's just like every other kind of magical, natural process. It just gets into you and you learn, whether you like it or not. You know, I mean, we are learning.
Were you able to make that jump then from being their volunteer to get into the professional aspect of this work?
Well, yeah. Okay. So I kind of went off on a tangent.
I love your tangent. It was very rich. Keep going. Yeah.
Well, I volunteered and then I just started bugging them. I'm like, come on, you guys, you could hire me. And they're like, well, you know, not really. And we're going back to Arizona and we're done here. And then I just kept in contact. I kept sending them different things and kind of letting them know I wasn't going away. And at some point the phone rang and they offered me a job at the Bronx Zoo building trees, you know. So do you think you could build trees? And I'm like, sure. We can figure that out. Yeah. Great. So, you know, it was after this volunteer effort that I was just captivated by the whole situation. And then there was opportunity. So it was magic.
Wow. Was it scary magic or just very exciting?
Very, very scary. Very scary. I had no idea what was going on. And it was a huge leap of faith to go to New York from Oregon, into an environment I had no clue what that was going to be like. Construction in New York City on a big, huge cultural project. And Jungle World took 3.5 years. And then after that, Central Park Zoo got rebuilt. And I was also working on the trees there. And then, you know, pretty much building trees of all different kinds for all different reasons ongoingly since the 80s.
Wow. Yeah. Now, how did you clear out of that way of being the girl? Did you find it just didn't matter after a while?
I never, no way to clear out from being a girl. That's just the way it is. eventually there were maybe totally on that project, maybe six significant contributors that were women on our crews anyway, on the building crews, but mostly it's a guy's world. It's hard work. It's hard physical labor. I mean, you know, not everybody can stand up to it or has the skills or the interest to just be, you know, worn out. And so
you seem to find it fascinating to be in the life of, for example, to be in attunement, I guess, with trees or with nature, even rocks. You really get with the rocks. Yeah. It's right in your soul, isn't it?
It is. It's just so wonderful. You know, you could just sit in any one place and then observe all of the elements that make something into, you know, the magical place that it is. And whether it changes, whether it stays the same, what are the things that make it a beautiful environment?
Do you think going into the zoos that you created would help us understand animals better?
I think so. That whole development has just taken off. In those years, there weren't beautiful habitats everywhere, but now you look around the country and the world, and there are wonderful immersion habitats. There are really gifted people out there making them, designing them, building them, aquariums as well as zoos. It's quite interesting.
Maybe we'll be kinder to all life as a result, you know? I mean, because it's very appealing, isn't it, to be at home in an environment that is an animal's environment. You know what I mean? Get that understanding.
It is, but I just don't know I don't know if we're keeping up, Veronica. I don't know. I mean, it's one thing to make an artificial tree or an artificial environment to try to support something that is being destroyed, on the other hand, at a pace that, wow, how are we keeping up with that? Why is this in conflict anyway? How come? How mm-hmm. come mm-hmm. conservation has to be such a battle? You know, when did it get so divided that there's so many people, so many industries, so much desire to destroy the very planet we're living on? I don't get it. And then over here is another group of people trying to conserve it or preserve it. Why is there a conflict? I'm not clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
why are we at odds? You know,
I think the dream, from my perspective, as I listen to you develop, I can almost feel you developing, for example, the New York Zoo, all of that kind of thing. And I go, it really sort of makes us feel the presence, the home, and sometimes the behavior of these animals, I think. But I guess it doesn't hit enough people because it's always about money, isn't it?
Well, I just want to, I mean, here we are, whether it's whichever environment it is we're trying to protect. I mean, for instance, I have some acquaintances, some friends who are in Madagascar right now. And what they're seeing there is so extraordinary. It's so unique. And it's just on that own, you know, it had been allowed to develop on that island by itself over centuries. And yet, or someplace in Africa or any continent, pick a continent, pick an environment that's threatened. And there are not enough people in those places to, the reason why they're not being destroyed is there are not enough people there to overcome allowing them to remain. Or we're on this brink. It's like, you know, it was so important to log all the rainforests for wood, okay, and nobody was keeping up with the biodiversity and the systems that are saving, protecting, and holding the planet in its very own hands.
Well, you just said it. I don't think we're not taught enough about how we really need, for example, the trees. We need the biodiversity to keep life, right? To sustain life. We're not taught that.
Right. No, that isn't the starting factor. It wasn't like, wow, look at this. Here's this incredible, quote unquote, resource. Mm-hmm. Well, it's in place. It was a resource, is a resource in place mm-hmm. without being displaced or changed or altered or dug up or so on and so on. I mean, I worry.
You're not alone. You're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I know we're kind of off the subject of it, but I mean, it's very interesting to be allowed to create beauty or have that be one's goal, you know, on an ongoing basis, that I could wake up in the morning and have the privilege of making something beautiful be my way of making a living, of making, you know, of my way of being, is that I'm allowed to, I have the pleasure of making something beautiful and putting it back into the world in whatever form that is.
Your beauty, the beauty you create, which is wonderful, is always, my memory is, it's just about always to do with nature, with trees, with rocks, with water, with the earth. Right.
Right. Or even some story, for instance, remember when you were telling me about the one of your own personal insights someday? I don't remember that. What was the deal when I painted the orange being pulled apart?
Oh,
that story
yeah.
of yours.
I said that because of a trauma that I had had and a betrayal I had, I felt like I was an orange that was just blown apart. Bursting in
right,
orange.
Right, segmented,
remember?
Right? That yeah. it was segmented?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
And the juice was right. running everywhere, yeah.
Right, and then that, while you were talking, I'm having this little vision myself, or I woke up with it the next day or something, and then I painted that painting.
And it's beautiful.
And, yeah, and it has, like, all the colors of the chakras, and the orange is coming apart, and then isn't there some little flame inside there or something?
Mm-hmm. There's a person, I believe.
Anyway. Yes, like a little Buddha flame coming out of the bottom of that thing.
No, it's beautiful.
That was a while ago.
Yeah, so let's swing back to New York, talking about a while ago.
Okay.
How'd you get from New York to your next place? Did you come back to Oregon?
No, to Arizona. So from New York in the mid-80s, and then Arizona for some period of time, and then to Central Oregon in the early 90s, then back to Arizona, the desert, the Sonoran Desert, as you know, is just a magical place.
Just magical.
And right, and then back to Oregon in the late 90s. So there was lots of self-discovery and transition and things going on ongoingly, right? Where am I supposed to be? What am I doing?
You were doing yoga and consciousness stuff. But also then, when did you start with the trees? For example, the ones that are chandeliers in great places like Grand Central Station or like some...
That was another big, huge transitional opportunity. I was approached by a New York artist and asked to design and build a big chandelier that's hanging in Grand Central Terminal even now. So that was the late 90s, a big, huge, another opportunity. That person came to me because of all the other trees that I'd been building. He had the idea of the chandelier and didn't know how to build it. And someone else in his world said, well, if you need trees, you need her.
Good.
So, it was like a call. Yeah, that started when I was in Arizona in the late 90s. But by the time it was built, we first talked about it in 96, and then it was finally built in 99. It was installed, and because Grand Central Terminal was going through a big renovation at that time, the whole terminal was renovated, including the big rotunda and the gorgeous, mural that's on the ceiling of all the celestial bodies. I don't know if you know the big...
No, I don't, actually. I haven't been there, no.
Yeah, and so the chandelier is in a small side gallery part of Grand Central Terminal. So, yeah, that started that in the late 90s. And then that's kind of transitioned into another... It did have crystals on it, but no lights.
Mm-hmm.
And so now there's all kind, and that's changed so much too over the years. Instead of there being incandescent lights, now there's LED lights. We've made some that have fiber optic light in them. That was kind of another field, as fiber optics sort of came out, those 1,000 points of light, that seemed like a really intriguing thing to try. And the natural crystals, I've always wanted to have light transmitted through natural crystals as opposed to man-made crystals. And that's a little more challenging, harder to do, such dense material, but that the field of lighting has changed so much and is continuing to just rocket through development.
People might enjoy checking out your website and seeing some of the photos of things that you've installed and created. They are magnificent. It's breathtaking when you turn the lights on. Because usually they're in fairly beautiful, beautiful buildings as well, with arches and so on. But they are really lovely. So you just keep right on growing and going through it, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to? Yes. I just want to say there's a big eagle that's been watching us from the tree in front of my window here.
Oh,
which
thank you very much.
I thought you'd appreciate that. Anyway, so carry on because I'm very excited about the progression you've been through with, I would call it light. Would you say light is one of the progressive tools you've been using all the way along? Maybe every artist is.
Oh. I think so. And that whether that's in the piece or, natural light settings that are what light does. What a fabulous thing to even think about. What light does, how it travels, shadows, that whole, the whole aspect of the shadow side of anything is, I mean, you can think of it as the absence of light, or more, you could think of it as something in between you and the light, which is really more like what a shadow is. But what is the thing that makes a shadow? That could be beautiful too, right? We're in
Wow.
the moon.
So what do? Do you
Yeah.
walk around and look for things? Like what inspires you, Jonquil?
Oh my gosh.
How many things inspire you, Jonquil?
So many things inspire me, and most of them are in nature, or how other people interpret nature and speak of it, say in books. So, I mean, I read a lot, and a lot of the things that inspire me are how such creative people put together such creative sentences, and maybe that's the way I think of the sculptures too. They're like writing something or trying to say something in a different dimension. And so anyone will interpret it a certain way, but with its own language, correct? Yeah. What is the language of trees or rocks or air or water? Like words. And if you wait long enough or stay with one of them long enough, you can learn a lot of things with one word or one sentence or one moment in a day. Fall's a fabulous example. I mean, here I am walking my dog this morning, and every single day I walk in the same place, right? So you would think, oh, well, boring. Looks the same today as it looked yesterday? Not at all. Oh no. Oh no. There's something fabulous every single minute if you're observing.
And do you take photographs while you're walking or when you're walking?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I do. This morning I didn't, but the thing I saw this morning that I thought, oh, I should paint that or take a photo of, but didn't do, was I'm in this field, and there's a lot of evergreens kind of spotting all around. But then there's also a lot of deciduous trees all losing their leaves at different rates and colors. And I see this one beautiful Doug fir. And as I walk around, then this little, I think it was an alder, comes into where it's just being held by the outline of this Doug fir. So this big green pattern or color, and then as and when I'm walking along, and the yellow splotch isn't in focus or a part of that, but as I keep walking, then pretty soon this little yellow tree is completely embraced by this large green tree, only just for a second while I'm standing there. Then I walk past, and then they're not related to each other.
Oh,
Then I
man.
look around, and I realize this relationship is going on between a lot of other trees. One big tree sheltering a smaller one. And I'm like, wow, I never saw that before. Not at all.
Oh, that's
Mark.
wonderful. Did you climb trees as a
Something.
kid?
I did. I did. And I can remember we did a lot of things to trees when we were kids. One summer we lived in Maine, and I don't think I was that nice all the time, but if somebody else couldn't climb a tree as well as we could, my sister and I, we'd sort of badger them about it. Oh, go on. It's not that hard.
That's what kids do,
We might
right?
have been, I know, we kind of, I'm not going to say we were mean, but I would say we had expectations, right?
Chat, you were challenging. But did you have the same? I bet you didn't quite have the same deep appreciation for trees at that time, or did you?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, everything is a learning situation, I think. You just, I hope, or for me, it always is. It's, a challenge in learning. And that's one thing I would want to say about that time at the Bronx. You know, first it was like, I just really want to do well. I want to know how to do this. I want to be great at this, you know, and that's sort of self-centered and personal, right? And the other was then, and then
I don't know. I think that's called ambition, and we have to have a degree of that, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it was like, no, come on, other people can benefit from this. And it's just in terms of if it was happening on so many levels. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing. We're making it up. So at the same time, you're testing your own imagination and trying to find a way to do something. Then there's someone else there waiting for you to teach them how to do it. And that was really a big challenge. It's like, I have to figure this out, be really good at it, and then get others to learn how to do it too. And come along. We'll all go along together. Let's make something great. But there's just that edge of if you're a teacher, I mean, that I think in some ways, my mother was a teacher. And if I had been a teacher, I probably would have been a good teacher.
Mm-hmm. Because you have a command of the detail and you have an understanding of what they need, the trees as well as the students.
And right? Other, you know, you can do this too. You can do this too. Let's get this so you can do this, you know. And also on the other side of that, look how different it can be if we can all learn something. If you can learn something and then teach somebody that and then they've got the grasp of it, it's much better. Possibility. There's more possibility. That's education, right? That's education.
Well,
that could be.
It could be evolution.
And it's an E word, right?
Well, the reason I say that is if you bring the life of trees, for example, into your fabrication of them, you obviously have to have an understanding. And then if they're in the zoo and we're getting the habitats of animals and so on, there's a whole lot of growth from people's comprehensions of animals, of trees, mm-hmm. of rocks. You know, I've learned a lot just knowing you through the years of just seeing rocks. I see rocks differently because of some of the paintings you've done. I look at mm-hmm. them with a different viewpoint. And then there's always Frank Zappa's old song, which is "Help, I'm a Rock." But then extrapolating from that, you moved from the beauty of rocks into learning about crystals and gems. And do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, that. Where did that come from? Did that come from you? I can't remember. It was so long ago.
I don't remember. Yeah, I just really remember that you have a link between pebbles in a stream and some comprehensions.
It was always just that. Mm-hmm. Right. And somewhere in there it was just another field of interest, really. Just this beautiful natural world that we live in, and then jewelry, and then the healing nature of different crystals and learning about that. And okay, where are all these wonderful materials found naturally, right? Because mm-hmm. they're all over the planet as well. And in spite of all of the manipulation that man does, even to gemstones, let's say, for instance,
there was a moment in time
when I think of this in India or Sri Lanka or somewhere, you know, these streams are running down out of the mountains, and these tiny little pebbles coming down out of these mountains are what? They're sapphires and rubies. And somebody's out there looking at these tiny little pebbles, precious tiny little pebbles, and hold them up and they go, oh, what's that? You know, emeralds, rubies, and sapphires. In a natural state or anything else, you know, quartz. Think about that. You know, now they're just, this kills me. So we think we're so clever, you know, we discover things, right? Okay, what about all those incredible caves that they discovered and they're looking for water or something else and they came down, I know some of they're mining something else. And they come down into these extraordinary caverns with these humongous quartz crystals. I mean, and then, you know, remember that article from National Geographic where you see these people and they're like a half inch tall and they're standing on these individual crystals that are just the size of God knows what, you know, they're
wow.
so big. And, you know, it's like, wow, look what we discovered. Oh, you are walking around on a treasure trove. The whole world, the whole earth is these fantastic underwater, above ground, the underground, fantastic resource of beauty and natural power, all these things. We really aren't paying close enough attention. Honest to God, Veronica, what's going on? You know,
well, we don't stop and bear and take our vision
stop.
Inside. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And say what? Okay. So we just discovered this. We just learned this. And what did we learn it for? What did we find it out for? How, why, you know, what is it like to come upon a stream full of salmon and fish or whatever it is? And you only need one out of the 5,000 of them to eat and to get through to the next day. So what's wrong with leaving the other 5,000 in there, or the 4,999 in there for the next person or the next thing?
Do you think people ever, do you think,
go back to the ocean?
Do you think our society ever knew that way back when?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. What are the turning points that turned natural resources into this grabbing, greedy, change the earth, change the world? Was it industrialization? What was it? Was it gradual? I mean, what the hell?
I know exactly what you're saying. It's like,
we know societally, when we look back through society as far back as we can, we get that man wasn't always kind to men, right? Or they had slaves, or they abused a certain group of people to build a temple or to build this and that and the other thing. Or we're looking for, but is it just volume of people? There have been so many turning points.
I think it is volume of people. And I think it's fear. We spoke about this before we got going on the show. But it's fear in people, too, that I better grab as many of these as I can because I need to have a backlog, right? And now we don't know if we're going to have enough to go around just to keep everybody alive, you know. But we don't want to get into the really darker end of things.
No. Or is it the long-term thinking of it? Like, there's some kind of an imagination, an ability to transform one thing into another, and that we see in all levels of things, or the curiosity to, if I do this, then I can learn that. Yet, then at some point, there's a difference between, you know, exploring the universe, building a telescope, making a machine that can do this, that, or the other thing industrially, whether that's, you know, moving water or plumbing or whatever. At some point it spun into other reasons
mm-hmm.
for extracting natural resources
mm-hmm.
that I obviously don't have the brain capacity to hold all that together. And
But let me interrupt you just for a moment, because you and I know that when you know, we talk back about the sapphires and emeralds and so on, a lot of people, I won't say billions and billions, but a number of people have done a lot to bring forward the healing qualities in all of those, because you and I know that everything that we need help with does exist in a natural form, doesn't it?
We know that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But how to bring that forward in a way that would make it available to all people, that's a very interesting question. I don't expect you to have the answer for it, nor myself, but isn't it an interesting question?
It is. How does that, in your mind, relate then to vibration, right? Everything is vibrating. Everything has energy in it of some sort, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of a size. And then if you group things together, they have more energy that make them go in a certain direction or complex direction. And is it that we've, I mean, it's strange to think that we really have some kind of power to divert energy into a direction that it might go for a short period of time, but is not its intrinsic value. So then it just falls apart. Is that possible?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, going back to the first part of your question, was that knowing that we're vibrational beings, for starters, is not a common knowledge for people. People are busily adhering to the parameters of being a rock or a person, right? Just it is a thing, right? So they don't get the mm-hmm. vibrational. Everything's got a vibrational motion to it, doesn't it? But that's a whole other mm-hmm. discussion, which is very exciting to me, because I'm banking on the fact that a number of beings are choosing to move vibrationally to, well, some people call it ascension, but to move up and out of the melee, so that we're relating to the universal flows and energies, and we have a different sense of life than what we've had before. Is that too esoteric to bring on this show?
I'm not sure.
Well, this is going to have to be a future conversation. We're almost out of time, and what I'd like to ask you is, would you tell us just a little bit about the TED Talk you just did? And people can find it, but I'd love them to know what it was all about for you.
Well, you know that there are TED Talks all over the world, and they're independently organized groups in different cities and towns. And here in Portland, one of those is TEDx Mount Hood. And I was invited by them this year to be their, what they call an artist in residence, which is an artist who's invited to design and put their artwork on the stage, where at the daily live event, all the speakers will be standing in association with. So you've decorated a stage with your art for all of the performers and speakers of the day, and also give it a little talk. So
I'm honored to tell everybody that I was there. I watched it, and it was marvelous. And the decor on the stage was wonderful. I'm looking forward to when the TED Talk comes out, TEDx Mount Hood.
Yes, and that isn't released at this time after the live event. Everything is edited, and each person's talk is then consolidated, and they give you the link, and you can go and watch that. And so I'm looking forward to that link, and I can share that with everybody.
You know what I really love about our whole conversation is you're doing these, we're talking about the world and the melee of the world, and how people don't have respect for nature enough, and it's kind of getting more difficult to get it up there. But your talk and a lot of TED Talks bring those things forward, and they're becoming very well recognized around the world. It's a really big service for you to have that out there to bring forward for people to understand.
I hope so.
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
I hope so.
So
yeah.
Maybe humans are going to come forward in ways that can generate awakening amongst a lot of people that might learn to appreciate nature in different ways, for starters, right?
Yes.
Well, anyway, I always enjoy speaking with you. We've been speaking with Jonquil LeMaster, and her website is JQ, is it? What's your website, Jonquil?
My website is Jonquil, my name spelled out, J-O-N-Q-U-I-L, and then a hyphen design.
Wonderful. And it's really worth taking a look and seeing all these amazing photos that you've got up of your wonderful work, Jonquil.
Thank you.
And I say thank you for being a paradigm shifter, because you are shifting the way people think about rocks and trees and nature all around. So thank you for coming onto the show.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
Fan. And you've been listening to Veronica Entwistle with Paradigm Shifters and meeting Jonquil LeMaster. Thank you for listening.